MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
Well, what an interesting week. Anything going on in special? Well, what's caught my attention yesterday is Tulsi Gabbard, the always interesting Tulsi Gabbard, saying, Senator, in this hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator, the only person who can determine what is and is not an imminent threat is the president. The fiscal 2025 intelligence budget is $101.6 billion. And that is the primary responsibility of the intelligence agencies to warn the president of an imminent threat. So take it away.
Look, Tulsi Gabbard is a source of endless a gift who keeps on giving with all her mishaps. But a couple things. First of all, she was grilled about a subject we have talked quite a bit about and written quite a bit about, which is her bizarre appearance at the Fulton County Courthouse for an FBI raid on Fulton County county ballots to try to prove that there was some sort of manipulation with the 2020 vote and Donald Trump actually won. She repeated yesterday that Trump had asked her to do that. The follow-up question is, when did he ask you? And she said the day of the raid.
Yeah,
which
I saw
was January
that.
29th. So she hops on a plane, I mean, that morning to get down there. It just seemed very
bizarre.
Well,
she has nothing else to do.
Right. But look, we should talk about her former chief of staff, the now former chief of national counterterrorism, Mr. Kent, who resigned in an extraordinary letter saying that there was no imminent threat from Iran. By the way, I think this is the second high-ranking official in the United States government, and I'm going back many years here, to resign over
Iran.
Secretary
of State, yeah.
Yep. Cyrus Vance, Secretary of State, back during the Carter administration. But look, as accurate as he might have been on his opening sentence in that letter, his reasons for resignation, everything he said afterwards was, you know, filled with anti-Semitic tropes and the suggestion that his wife died because of a war manufactured by Israel. Manufactured, that was the word he used. His wife died in Syria fighting ISIS, a war that both, you know, Obama and Donald Trump in his first term had viewed as very much in the national interest because of what ISIS had become. But look, you bash Israel and, you know, you immediately go on Tucker Carlson, which he did. And, you know, he's going to be speaking with Candace Owens at an event in Washington on Friday. He is feeding what I think is really, malicious conspiracy theories.
Well, he pals around with the Proud Boys and the white supremacists.
Yeah, he was an election denier.
He should never have been the head of national counterintelligence.
Oh, and let's remember something we reported on a few months ago, which is, remember the whole Trent de Aragua debacle in which the National Intelligence Council did a report saying that this Venezuelan gang was not being controlled by the Venezuelan government?
Yep.
And Tulsi Gabbard immediately disputes that. And then it emerges that Kent had actually called the head of the National Intelligence Council, Mike Collins, and said, hey, can you change this so you can be, you know, online, in line with the administration? So that doesn't sound like speaking truth to power to me. And of course, Collins later got fired. So anybody wants to make a hero of Kent, you know, has a lot to explain.
I want to get back to what Jeff started with when he brought up the story, which was the president decides what's imminent. You know, this is one more example of saying the quiet part out loud. That is how the reality is right now. The president decides, as opposed to the profession of sort of, you know, getting recommendations to the table, diving into what they actually mean, and then coming up with some kind of, you know, reasoned, concerted, knowledgeable, dare I say, wise decision. You know, look, also in her testimony, she didn't use the word that they obliterated, right? In her written testimony. She changed her testimony from the written to the oral. Again, with the idea of fealty, with the idea of I'm going to show my allegiance. You know, of all the people in the government, well, we can talk about the Justice Department in another one, but to show your allegiance when your job is to oversee and coordinate intelligence and intelligence briefings and how it gets to the president, how it gets to the National Security Council. I mean, it's really not nothing. It's not just about words. These word differences matter. And I do think that that this idea that the president is our chief intelligence officer, or however you want to, you know, play it out.
But Karen, the president does make he can decide on action,
but not what the intelligence is.
That's different than saying, is there an imminent threat or not? That's different than saying than feeding what the intelligence is. Making the decision about it is a different thing than the way this has played itself out. That's all.
Yeah. Say what you will about the foreign policy establishment, the intelligence establishment, aka the deep state. The rules until Trump were that the intelligence community offers its best judgment, and the president weighs that. But he seems to have gotten in the middle.
Jeff, we've talked a lot.
I think we're being naive. Mike thinks we're being naive.
Yes, yes. Come on. We've talked a lot about, you know, the eerie parallels with the Iraq War.
Okay, that's fair.
We all know the extent to which the CIA under George Tenet fashioned its intelligence.
Pressured by the vice president.
Fashioned its intelligence to meet what the White House wanted. And that is traditionally how things have gone. I'm not aware of an ODNI director or a CIA director, for that matter, who has ever stood up to a president and said, Mr. President, you're wrong. You know, you can't do what you're planning to do. I mean, that just doesn't happen in the United States government. So as wacky as Gabbard is, I might give her a small pass on that one explanation. But can we just talk about what I think is the
point taken?
Okay. Big news this week, you know, the reports
among what other
among many. All right. The reports today that the White House is going to ask for $200 billion from Congress to fight this war.
That's so where the rubber hits the road.
We already have spiraling gas prices. You add a price tag like that on top of it, it's really hard to see how Trump can sustain public
and they
support.
Didn't say for how long or what they thought that would cover, or, you know, it was just like this massive amount without any kind of further
and even Thune, when asked about it, was like equivocal. Well, we'll have to see how they're going to spend that. So it's a sign.
It also came up in the reports just when they were reporting that $188 billion had been spent of ours on Ukraine over the course of this war, which also I hadn't quite seen that number before, just to put this one in context, this request in context. Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more about Iran because we have this terrific guest today, Houman Majd, who is an Iranian-born American journalist, author, and political commentator who's focused, of course, on Iranian affairs. He had a very interesting background. He grew up as the son of Iranian diplomats under the Shah. Was educated in England and the United States, including graduated from GWU here in Washington. He's published three influential books about Iran. One was called The Ayatollah Begs to Differ. Another one called The Ayatollah's Democracy, an Iranian Challenge. And another one, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay, an American Family in Iran. He recently wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Review of Books called This Is My War, The Experience of Home in a Conflict That Is Doubly Mine, in which he talks about or writes about how conflicted he is about the U.S. attacks on Iran. So without further ado, let's bring on Houman.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Hunan Mach, welcome to Spy Talk. It's really a pleasure to have you here because you have really unique experience having been born of Iranian diplomats back during the days of the Shah of Iran, but you were educated mostly abroad in England and the United States, including graduating from George Washington University right here in Washington, D.C. But you've also served as an interpreter, translator for Iranian presidents visiting while they were visiting in New York at the United Nations. So this is really some unique insight. Now, I was thinking this morning that I was remembering a joke from the so-called 100-hour war back in 1991, and the joke went around that after we swept the Iraqis out of Kuwait, the joke went around that there was a big banner around the Pentagon saying, "We do deserts, not jungles," meaning, you know, this is, we're really good at in places where there's no jungles like Vietnam, where we can kick ass across the Middle East. Well, we look to be in a stalemate of sorts. There's no question about the Israeli and the U.S. military superiority against the Iranians, but here we are stuck in a political quagmire. Is that the way you see it? And what way do you think the Iranians will get out of it?
Well, I'm not sure. First of all, thank you for having me. I'm not sure the Iranians want to get out of it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think stalemate might be somewhat a little too early to say it's a stalemate. It might actually be more like Iran's got the upper hand. Mm. Might be too generous to say it's a stalemate at this point. And when I say that, I don't mean that Iran is beating the United States militarily.
Of course not.
Or beating Israel militarily. Of course not. Mm. Missiles are landing in Tel Aviv. Yes, we know that. Israelis are dying. Iranians are dying in much greater numbers. We know all that. And the Iranian military has been pummeled and many of its assets have been destroyed.
Yep.
That said, when I say upper hand is because it appears, at least now, it has appeared for the last few days, that the Trump administration really didn't figure out what was going to happen when they decided to strike Iran. Israel is a different story. Israelis may have well known what was going to happen, and their goals in this war are probably quite different from what Trump's goals are. But apparently, they didn't expect Iran to attack regional countries, even though Iran had said for months after the first Gulf War that if they're attacked again, it's no more Mr. Nice Guy. We're going to blow up everything. They
right.
said that.
None of this was a secret. So
none of it was a secret.
Their claims that they didn't know are bizarre.
And well, Trump said that absolutely no one knew, which is factually incorrect. All the media knew because they, and certainly the Persian Gulf Arab states knew because they were coming and besieging Trump. Please don't attack Iran. If you do, they're going to come back and hit us.
Which
is exactly what happened. And then the claim that they didn't know that Iran would close the Strait of Hormuz. The Strait of Hormuz isn't actually closed, and Iran figured out that they don't need to close it. All they need to do is hurt a couple of ships that are passing through, and other ships just aren't going to risk it. I mean, that's it. That's the end of story. And that they can continue to do for a very long time. So the choices the United States has, I mean, you see this on social media, you read it in the papers every day, you see it on television. Oh, what are we going to do? How do we solve this? Oh, Trump is begging other countries to send their ships and minesweepers. I mean, mines aren't really the problem, to escort some of these tankers. How do we do this? China and Russia, you got to help me here. Everyone's got to help. You know, you didn't ask for help when you started the war, but now you need help. So that clearly is an indication that there's a little bit of, uncertainty in the administration, even though the propaganda says, oh, we're doing great. We're destroying the military. We've destroyed everything in Iran. The reality is the way to stop Iran from ever being able to threaten those ships in the Persian Gulf, in the Strait of Hormuz, is to land troops on Iran, on Iranian soil. One way to do it is to land troops just on the coastline where Iran controls the Strait of Hormuz.
Trump, he goes back and forth. He's like a ping pong ball on his opinions about the war. He's now saying that he's not going to send troops.
He said that, but they've also not ruled it out. And what's happening with the 2,500 Marines? Where are they going to go? Are they going to take Harg Island? I don't know. Again, as I said, there's two ways to end this war for Trump, is either to land troops and go for a full-on regime change a la, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, or to just, basically occupy parts of Iran. And occupying the southern parts of Iran, the coastline, will result in American deaths. It will result in an insurgency. There is no question about that. The Iranians aren't just going to sit there and let the U.S. control their coastline. It's not going to happen. When I say upper hand, I mean, Iran's goal here has been to cause so much pain for both the United States and the regional countries that when they do sit down with the United States, they will actually extract more concessions than they could have on February 26th when they were sitting with Witkoff and Jared and offering what in their own minds a much, much better deal than they offered to Obama.
So the key question everybody's asking, or one key question, is what's going on inside the regime? And I don't know if you had a chance to catch Trump's bizarre press conference with the Japanese Prime Minister.
The Pearl Harbor conference.
He brings up Pearl Harbor. He was also asked about defections from within the regime, and he tossed it to Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who said, yes, we are seeing defections and also money movements of people, of Iranian officials trying to get their money out of the country. Have you seen any evidence of such defections? Do we have any idea who he's talking about? How many we're talking about? What do we know?
There's no evidence whatsoever. It would be any defection would immediately be paraded all over the media, including by people like the Shah's son, who has talked about having 50,000, members of the security forces ready to defect on his orders, ready to leave their posts. And money going out of Iran. How is money leaving Iran? How does Scott Bessent know that money's leaving Iran? Iran is not part of SWIFT. Iran has banking restrictions. The only way to send money out of Iran is through the hawala, the Islamic system, you deposit X number of, dollars here. Somebody deposits X number of dollars in an account for you and takes riyals in Iran because they need it to pay their employees or whatever. It's that bartery, Islamic
system.
It's kind
of a Western Union for
it. It's kind of a Western Union. And that is, there is very unlikely that the U.S. Treasury Department, they could probably catch a few of those by looking at Turkish banks. What are Turkish banks doing? What are Emirati banks doing right now? But there,
So there's no truth.
I don't know if there's no truth.
We don't know.
I take your point
that if there was any significant defection, it would be the U.S. and Israeli interest to parade that.
Absolutely. Give us the names. Give us the names, because if they're significant people, give us the names. I mean, you're basically the United States, or actually in this case, Israel, is basically killing all the significant people and have killed them. And with all that death, despite all that death and destruction, we don't see any serious senior members of the leadership in Iran defecting. Now, I should make a point here. There have been some reports, and we can't confirm them, that some members, lower level members of the security services, the ones who patrol the streets, the ones who might have to put down any insurrection by whomever is there, is uprising or protest, that some of those people aren't showing up to work. And that is possible. If you don't really want to go out and, you know, club your fellow Iranians on the head or shoot them, you might say, I'm calling sick, you know, whatever. So those reports are believable on some level. Mm-hmm. But given the video that we do see, and there's a lot of cell phone footage that is coming out of Iran of the security services on the streets, they don't look scared. They don't look like they're about to defect. And, you know, it's Persian New Year tomorrow. There's been a lot of shopping on the streets. We've seen a lot of videos of people who've been able to get videos out of, you know, crowds in the markets buying foodstuffs for the Persian New Year.
Do they shoot fireworks on New Year's Day in Iran?
No, they don't. No, not really. No, it's not a fireworks kind of day. No,
that could get a little confusing for people.
Yeah, very confusing. With the fireworks we saw today is, sadly for U.S. military, an F-35 jet was hit. CNN has confirmed that an F-35 jet was hit over the skies of Iran. And, I don't know how it made an emergency landing, and then they said that the pilot's been injured. I mean, so we don't know what the injury is. But this is the kind of thing that will, I assume, continue. You know, they'll get some hits. Iran will get some hits, unfortunately, for the Americans, who servicemen and women who will either get injured or killed.
Houman, just following up on that just a little bit, you know, there's so much talk about what Trump and his cohorts didn't expect, whether they did or didn't expect it, whether they were warned about it or not. I'm wondering if there's been any talk among experts about what else Iran might do if they wanted to escalate this war, and the kinds of things that America and Israel and others might be anticipating that we haven't heard about. Is there something that they're, I hope they don't go this far. What would that be? What would that look like?
Well, I think as of today, they're probably saying, I hope they don't go this far, because I mean, the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, just threatened the next time you hit one of our gas fields, we're going to seriously, again, no more Mr. Nice Guy, we're going to hit some of the bigger oil depots and oil pipelines and stuff in the region. So it could get much bigger. Iran has the ability to do that. And so far, I mean, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, I mean, they've put out statements, but they're really, I mean, there's not much they can do. There's not much they can do. And that would, I mean, Qatar has already admitted that they've lost, I can't remember what it was, 17% or something of their ability to produce 70%. Gas. Yeah. It's it starts to become bigger and bigger, the next hit and the next hit. So I have to assume that at the White House, in the Situation Room, the CIA, at the Pentagon, and in Israel, everyone is like thinking, okay, you know, should we hit another Iranian site? I mean, is that escalation worth it? Or if we hit another Iranian oil producing site, do we then have to, you know, think about how to protect these other sites?
One of the other things that's come up a lot in the American press is the different, trying to make a distinction between U.S. goals and Israeli goals. Mm-hmm. And so who knows how wide that conversation will be in terms of who wants what. But I'm wondering if, from the point of view of Iran and its allies, they have a sense of how to split the difference there, how to make them more divergent. Have you heard anything on that in that regard?
Not specific to that, but I think, well, definitely from the Iranian officials who have been on television, and certainly with what's said in the Iranian press and in the Iranian media that they speak to. Yes, I mean, Iran has never thought the U.S. and Israel are on the same page. I mean, Iran absolutely believes that Israel brought America to this war, convinced Trump to attack Iran. They've always seen Trump for what he is. He's a deal maker, wants to make a deal. For whatever reason, he was pushed into this war, was pushed into the war in the 12-day war in June of last year, and bombed the Iranian nuclear sites. They do know he's unpredictable, but they see Israeli goals to be to defang Iran to the point where it can never threaten Israel. So what you're seeing in Lebanon now, and what you're seeing with Iran, and what you saw in Syria,
Israeli domination over the Middle East, basically, and or domination and or detente with the Arab states, you know, deal with Saudi Arabia, deal with the UAE, deal with Bahrain. And Iran is the obstacle for all that to be always be possible for Israel. And so the Iranians say, yeah, we're always going to be against Israel's hegemony. And Israel's saying, well, if we can weaken you to the point, ballistic missiles being the prime example, because that's, you know, the nuclear is just an excuse now. You know, we want the nuclear missile, the ballistic missiles gone, the ability to put a nuclear warhead on a ballistic missile gone, because that way we will not be able to be the hegemon.
You know, I have to say, I was listening to another podcast that had Matt Duss, who was Bernie Sanders' foreign policy advisor, on. And he talked about how he'd recently been to Israel and met with Israeli officials, and they were very clear about what their goal was, and that was the ballistic missile threat, which appears to have been quite real, that the Iranians were expanding their ballistic missile sites and expanding their depth, and they could easily reach, coming to the point where they could easily reach Israel. And if that's not the nuclear program, but it's a very specific goal that they had. I mean, is it conceivable to you that they could say, that we could say in the next, you know, week or so, hey, we've decimated the ballistic missile program and its capabilities that, yeah, okay, no, let's declare victory and call a stop.
That would be very Trumpian to do. But Netanyahu is not Trump, and he recognizes that even if every single missile, every single one, down to the last missile has been destroyed, and every launcher has been destroyed, the regime, if the regime is standing, he can rebuild them. And so what are you going to do? Mow the grass every 6 months, every 8 months?
That's what they do with, that's what they've done with Gaza over the years.
That's what they've done with Gaza. But yeah, but it's much more expensive, much more complicated to do it with Iran. Gaza.
So just one more beat on that. Let's say Trump does what a lot of people think he ultimately will do, which is just declare victory. We've won.
Yeah.
The straits are still closed. Yeah. What do the Iranians do then? Do they open the straits if the bombing stops, or do they keep it shut?
I think they keep it effectively closed until they extract some concessions from the U.S. I mean, for Trump to just leave and not offer anything and just say, "Oh, well, we're stopping the war. We stopped the war." And even if he puts pressure on Israel to also stop the war, so Iran has been pummeled. It's been lost a few thousand probably of its citizens at that point, and doesn't have any sanctions relief, has no money, the economy's in the toilet. What are they going to do? Also stop the war? No, they're going to go to put pressure on the United States to get back to the table, but under circumstances where Iran can extract more.
What's an even conceivable concession that the United States could give Iran at that point?
There's two of them. One is sanctions relief, which is the biggest concession. Let them sell their oil, remove some of the banking sanctions. They've got $50 billion of their own money outside in banks, which are frozen. Let them access some of that so that the economy can improve, so that they don't have to face a public, which then rises up again like they did in January, which started, those protests started because of the economy and the inflation. So those are concessions that Iran wants. The other concession that it wants is, like, next time we sit down on the nuclear issue, you have to recognize the right that we have, the right to enrich uranium. Doesn't mean they're going to enrich uranium, recognize the right. Apparently that was on the table in these last round, and that Iran was willing to suspend enrichment for X number of years. You could argue that Iran would be happily suspending enrichment for 10, 15, even 20 years in negotiations, of course, if they were getting some relief that was going to kind of protect the regime. So really what all this boils down to is there going to be regime change or not? Because the only way you can get both Israel and the United States can guarantee that this issue of the nuclear crisis and the ballistic crisis goes away is if a regime is imposed on Iran, a new regime, because there is no groundswell inside Iran for a different regime.
I do want to pursue this question of regime change with you, but we have to take a short break our generous sponsors. We'll be back in a second. Okay, we're back, Houman. Let's talk more about regime change.
Regime change, yeah.
What is the regime now? Who's running things?
Well, it's basically mostly the IRGC that are running things, the Revolutionary Guards, the powerful military force inside Iran. They are basically, well, they're running the war for sure, which is the priority for Iran. And they're running and they're keeping security on the streets of Iran. So that's why they shut the internet down, is because they believe that, you know, there are spies inside Iran, all kinds of both spies from Mossad and the CIA, but also internal, dissidents who may want to take advantage of the war and the situation. So that's the reason they argue they've shut down the internet, basically, essentially shut down the internet. So they're in charge of that. In terms of the economy, in terms of, you know, providing basic services and everything, the president's still there, and the administration is there. So far, Israel has not assassinated or tried to kill any of the Iranian cabinet members, except one, the Minister of Intelligence.
Would step forward if there were to be negotiations with the United States? And I suppose that's the way wars end, is through negotiations. So who would emerge to talk to the United States?
Well, emerging right now, the person who was talking to the United States, the only person who was talking to the United States, was Araghchi, Foreign Minister Araghchi, who had direct contact with Steve Witkoff initially, and then with Witkoff and Kushner. They both admitted that they had each other's cell phone numbers and they were communicating, chatting on WhatsApp at some point. So he does speak English. He is the foreign minister. He, in all probability, will be the person who will be put forward. He will be reporting to both the IRGC, the new supreme leader, the president, Pezeshkian. There will be this group of people, the new national security advisor, who hasn't been appointed yet to replace Larijani, who was assassinated this week. The regime is there. It's working. If you, again, as I said, if you look at scenes of Iran today, it does not appear that the place is chaotic. Markets are open. It is Persian New Year, as I said. And so people are shopping, people are out on the streets, men and women, women without hijab, women with hijab. No one's bothering anybody right now as we speak. When I talk about regime change, it's not that there aren't people inside who want regime change. Those protests in January turned into protests against the regime. People did shout for regime change. They did bring up the Shah's son's name as well. People did chant his name. But the reality is that was just a kind of cry for help in a way, because when you say regime change, or when Donald Trump says, or Netanyahu says, you know, where people should go over and take over the government. But yeah, people can rush the, you know, national broadcasting headquarters and take over the TV station. Well, who's going to actually run it then? Who's going to be the leader? Who's going to create a government? And so far, there's no answer for that. There isn't an answer from the United States. Trump has dismissed the Shah's son as being not someone who should be
We don't see any evidence that the U.S. is supplying guns.
No,
or
no,
equipping,
not yet.
Say the Kurds.
No, that was a rumor.
They seem to have stepped back from that.
They seem to, yes, because that, you know, that could end up in a civil war in Iran. And basically, we do not want a situation. Iranians don't want a situation that is similar to Syria. And certainly the Turks don't want the Kurds. I'm sure Turkey's been talking to Trump, Erdogan, because if the Kurds start, they already are armed, but if they start attacking forces inside Iran, what does Turkey do about it? What do the Turkish Kurds do? What do the Iraqi Kurds do? It's a very complex issue. And then the other separatist groups, there's the Baluchis in the south, there's the Arabs in the southwest. And the Azeris in the north, who could potentially, there are people who are, you know, into taking advantage of the chaos that could come from the regime, a complete collapse of the regime.
But Houman, are you saying, I just want to get something clear. Are you saying that there's in some ways, not what's to come, but in some ways more cohesion within Iran than there was in the run-up to this? I know we've heard sort of conflicting reports of that. Or is it just that people are just, because when you say people are out on the streets, they're shopping, they're living their lives, Is there a sense of more defending the regime, whatever it is, whoever it is?
I think it's defending the country, really, more than defending the regime. And we've seen some of those reports. I mean, the Financial Times has a reporter on the ground, Najmeh Bozorgmer, who's a great reporter. She lives in most of her, half the time in Iran, half the time in London. She did a whole report, Pita Ghaffari, another Financial Times report, did a report. Yeah, I'm sure you guys saw it.
Yeah.
The people who may have welcomed surgical strikes against the regime because they were so fed up with the regime, they could see that are no longer welcoming surgical strike when they see 168 school children killed, when they see, you know, people on the streets in Tehran, you know, to kill, for example, to kill the intelligence minister, not a nice guy, fair enough, but to kill him, they had to blow up a street in his neighborhood, basically. They blew up his building, but it also destroyed apartment buildings next door. They're killing people and people are under rubble. So the sense that, you know, Iranians are going to welcome, it's this, back to the same old story, the idea that if we went into Iraq, we'd be welcome. Our soldiers would be welcome with flowers. The same, it's the same
treated concept. Treated as liberators.
Liberators. Right. And you know, the liberation, you start to see more and more of that from inside Iran. I've started to see more and more from inside Iran and from even the diaspora, which in some of the diaspora who were like, well, yeah, it'd be okay if they killed Khamenei, for example, and they killed some of those brutal people who put down these protests and killed thousands of Iranians in January. And maybe the regime will change if that happens. Maybe it provides an opening for someone else to take over. But now that they're seeing this kind of destruction and death, or as Pete Hegseth says, death and destruction from the air, you start not particularly liking it.
One of the main reasons we wanted to have you on again on the podcast is because you, as well as anybody, understands the thinking of the Iranian leadership. You were a translator for regime officials, including Ahmadinejad, the former Holocaust-denying president of Iran. Give us a sense of their thinking. To what extent is it, you know, theological with visions of apocalypse around the corner, which is, you know, standard Shiite preaching? And to what extent is there a pragmatic side? I mean, we want to get inside their head.
I would argue that Ahmadinejad was the first to bring up the apocalyptic Shia, you know, end of times and the missing imam is going to arrive on earth with Jesus by his side, and
which,
you know,
is a part of Shiite ideology.
It is, but he was the first one. But he was actually he was scolded by the Ayatollahs in Rome. They said, "It's not your place to say things like that. It's not our place to say things like that." I mean, he was a lay person. He was not a cleric, so it wasn't popular. And when he did start say that at the beginning of his term, he was scolded. People did react negatively to it. Other Ayatollahs like, this is not okay. Today I would argue the regime is much more pragmatic, at least the people at the top, nationalistic, I would say, especially at a time of war. And they don't really see this as a religious war. I mean, we see some Americans saying it's a religious war. Lindsey Graham said it was a religious war. But Iranians...
Pete Hegseth this morning.
Pete Hegseth continues to say it's a religious war.
Pray to Jesus Christ while dropping the bombs.
Jesus
Christ.
Exactly. But no, I think the way, you know, all the Iranians in the leadership that I've met, they come across when you meet them in person, and if they're not propagandizing, you meet them in person, they may not be the kind of people that you and I want to hang out with or think are great people, great leaders, but they're pragmatic and they're practical. What they want is to survive.
I have seen reporting that the IRGC training manuals for all its, you know, people who they enlist very much, you know, tracks the Shiite end of times theology.
Sure. But, you know, there's some in the leadership, but let's remember also there are a lot of conscripts in the IRGC, in the troops. When you get called up at 18 years old to do your national service, you go to either the IRGC or the regular army. And so it doesn't mean that if you're in the IRGC, you're automatically going to believe all that. But, you know, listen, the Shiite religion, the Shiite version of Islam, includes, you know, chest beating, includes all that stuff, you know, at the time of, you know, mourning for the Imam Hussein and Karbala, the Battle of Karbala. There's all this stuff, which is very, very, you know, Opus Dei almost, like, you know, the Catholic Church is like, but that doesn't mean that people, it's there in their minds, in the back of their minds. It doesn't mean they're going to act on it. Or, first of all, many ayatollahs have said it's not up to humans to bring about the end times. It's not the place of humans to cause an event or events to bring about the Imam's return with Jesus. That has to happen. The Messiah has to come on his own.
Let me ask you about this blending of religion with tactics and the assumption of power by the IRGC, only by elimination. We had reports that drones were flying over a base just outside of or Fort McNair here in the district, where Pete Hegseth and
Rubio
live. Mm-hmm. They moved there for security reasons, and now there's the report of drones. Can you see hardliners and the IRGC activating? Well, this is a two-part question. Does Iran have assets in the United States that it could mobilize to attack American targets? And two, do you think there are hardliners in the IRGC? And that's asking for a wild guess. IRGC leaders who would say, let's go for it, let's really shake them to their boots with an attack in Washington, D.C., kind of a 9/11, maybe not on the scale of 9/11, more on the scale of the Viet Cong attack on the U.S. Embassy at Tet, look, the so-called Tet attack.
Anything is possible. I would argue that there are people inside the IRGC who may, if you want to call them rogue agents, who would want to do something, you know, spectacular to show that they're, you know, ideological and powerful. You know, I think, I believe that most of the alleged assassination plots by the IRGC, even the ones where people were arrested and tried and convicted inside the United States, were probably set up not at the highest levels in Iran. But that said, yes, I mean, you know, does Iran have assets in the U.S.? Sure, Iran has. When I say they have assets, I'm not sure it's like, you know, that they're running agents inside Iran the way that Mossad is running agents or CIA is running agents inside Tehran. But they have supporters. They have a lot of supporters. And you could have, you know, lone wolf attacks. Right now, you've got people inside in the United States, Muslims who are either Shia Muslims, particularly if they're Shia Muslims, particularly Lebanese Shia Muslims, who are seeing people getting killed in Beirut and their homes demolished, who decide, you know, that they're loyal to Iran and that they should attack American interests for having started.
Can you put any numbers on that? The number of Shia Iranians living in the United States, and of that number, some vague percentage of who might be motivated to do this?
Let's put it this way. There's a couple of million, 2 million or so Iranian Americans in the United States. 99% are Shia, but probably only 10% are actually practicing Shia. So many Iranians are secular who live here. Plenty of secular Iranians inside Iran, but the ones here are certainly a lot more secular. So I wouldn't even think it's
and it only takes a few.
It only takes a few. Lebanese, it's a big, you know, a different set of people. And the Lebanese are Shia, Sunni, and Christian. So you've got all three. Iranians are some Armenian, some Jewish Iranians. So you could discount those necessarily. But not necessarily. It depends. Somebody could be paid and decide to do it for money. But no, it's hard to say. Is there a danger? I automatically think anytime you're at war, there's danger. There's always a danger. On the homeland. I don't think Iran has any ability to do much damage to the homeland, but, you know, lone wolves, one or two assets that may exist. And the other thing I was going to say is that, you know, Iran views this battle as existential. Unlike, you know, the Shah, who had the ability to get on a plane and leave and get political asylum, well, he hoped, be able to live his life outside the country. People, including my own family, my father was an ambassador. He could leave and go to London and settle there. Where are these people going to go? the only place that they could have conceivably have gone if there was regime change or if they were going to flee was Syria. And that's out of the question now. Beirut is out of the question now. Moscow, they don't want to go to Moscow. I mean, it's like that's
who
not...
Does?
Well, Assad is apparently Assad is having a good
Edward
time.
Edward Snowden,
there, but, yeah, but the Iranians are not interested in going to Russia. So, and it's not even clear if the Russians would even have them. You know, so it's existential for them. This battle is existential. They will fight to the last man. They believe that a regime change, mainly because the people in the diaspora and the MEK, for example, other opposition group other than Pahlavi, have said that when we come there, you know, you guys are all going to stand trial, all the top leadership anyway, and anybody who has blood on his hands, there's, you know, vengeful talk among the diaspora. So they're like, okay, they're going to kill us anyway. So we're going to fight to the death here, you know. So we're going to fight to the death against whatever America and Israel put on the table.
Is there any sense of an ally that we might not know of or think about in terms of Iran and who they might reach out to, who might help them? I mean, is there any sense of that at all? Or are they really this sense of isolation that we're feeling and sort of the IRGC, et cetera, you know, being able to help in other places. Is there any,
for example, power? North Korea?
Yeah, North Korea potentially, but I don't think North Korea really has a big interest in Iran.
No.
They shared some nuclear secrets, but they didn't really. I mean, the one thing Iran would love to have is North Korea give them a couple of nuclear missiles at this point, I'm sure.
Terrific.
But how that would happen, I don't know. How that could happen, you know, without it being detected. No, I mean, they you know, Hezbollah has already, they fired, you know, what, 200 missiles into Israel, so we know what Hezbollah did.
Yeah.
The Houthis haven't really been activated or active. But
not
potentially,
yet.
Not yet. I say potentially, yeah. That's one ally. There's a couple of other countries that are have very decent cordial relations with Iran. Tajikistan is one, for example, and they share a border. Tajikistan has been always pro-Iran. Could Tajikistan potentially send them arms, ammunition?
Well, the Russians are, aren't they?
The Russians, yeah, the Russians, they'll play a game. The Russians always play a game with their allies. Look how what they did with Syria. I mean, the Russians act in Russian interests, and that's it. They don't act in anybody else's interest. They don't care about anybody else except the Russians. And that's been Iran's experience with the Russians going back to the 18th century. So, I don't think they're under any illusion. The Russians might give them, as we've seen all the reports, intelligence. They might love to see Americans get a bloody nose in Iran. I'm sure Putin is sitting there thinking, this is so great. This is so great that Trump is stuck here 3 weeks almost into 4 weeks into a war that he started and with no end in sight. I mean, I'm sure Putin is thinking, this is so great.
But, so I guess I had a wrap-up question for Houman. If Trump called you up this afternoon and said, what should I do? What would you tell him?
I would say get on the phone with the Iranians and see what they want and what you can do to stop this war, because it's not going to do us any good in America. It's not going to do the Iranians any good. And I actually don't even believe it's doing the Israelis much good right now. What Trump should want from the Iranians, and what the Iranians should want to give Trump, and the both sides give each other, is a non-aggression pact. If they sign a non-aggression pact, it covers Israel as well. Israel gets the satisfaction.
Israelis would never sign that.
Well, they don't have to sign it they don't have to sign it, because if the Iran signs a pact with the U.S. saying that they would not start any kind of aggression against the U.S. or its allies, that would bring in Israel, or its allies would bring in Israel.
So I must say that as much as that would make sense, I don't see Trump doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him doing it either.
He wants the war to end, but as the current cliche goes, Iran has a vote on when the war ends.
Yes, it does. But
to make such a deal with Iran, even if it were possible, it still leaves the fact that there's no regime change. The Iranians are still fighting. The Strait of Hormuz is closed off, and the Iranians can open and shut that door any day that they want to. And this is a humiliation for Donald Trump. I don't think he, I think he would be seen that way. And
by a lot of people, yes. Yes.
So, but I don't know.
I couldn't possibly give him advice to, you know, put ground troops and go for regime change, because that,
sure,
I think would be a disaster. So I don't know what other option he has. He has to extricate himself from this. The Iranians want the war to end. Obviously, they don't want it to go on forever. So what can he offer them and still claim a victory of sorts? I think he can still claim a victory of sorts. You know, he keeps saying they don't have a navy. They don't have this. They don't have that. They don't have a nuclear program. If Iran were to take that 400 kilograms of enriched uranium and you know, downgrade it to 1% enriched, or send it out of the country or whatever, if they did that, he could claim victory there. He could claim he got a better deal than Obama if he makes a deal with Iran. That's, well, at the end of the day, better deal than Obama is what he really wants to be able to say he did, and weakened Iran, and got a non-aggression pact so that Iran wouldn't attack Iran, bases, American bases or interests in the region, wouldn't attack Israel, wouldn't attack Saudi Arabia. I mean, to me, you could make an argument that that's a win, and well, that he wouldn't have gotten that without going to war. That's what
we can dream. and that's the way it is. March 19th, 2026. Thanks for coming on, Houman. You've been really a terrific guest. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thanks, Karen.
Nice
Thanks,
to see
Michael.
You, Houman.
Good to see you guys all. Take care.
And that's it for this week's BiTalk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google SpyTalk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.